Hello, this is Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Yay!
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. You know, it's summertime when Major League Baseball holds its annual All-Star Game. That game took place last night, and the American League defeated the National League by a score of 5-2. The All-Star Game also marks the halfway point in the season, and there have been a number of big surprises this year. One of those surprises has been the amazing performance by a member of the Los Angeles Angels as a hitter and a starting pitcher. Shohei Ohtani is the first person to be selected to the All-Star team as both a pitcher and a designated hitter slash outfielder. There have been some good hitting pitchers in baseball before, but nothing like Ohtani, who hit his 33rd home run just the other night.
Ball and two strikes to Shohei here. Oh, got it! Got it! Got it! 33!
Oh, wow. Where did that one go? That's his 11th home run versus left-handed pitching this year. He was slugging 680 versus lefties.
Come on. Did you see Justin Upton? He had his hands on his head, Macaulay Culkin style from Home Alone. Like, I can't believe what I just saw.
Oh, man.
463 feet.
A lot of excitement in baseball. Also this year, Major League Baseball is trying out some new rules with an eye towards speeding up the game and creating more offensive power. Are they working? What do you think of these changes? Well, today on Vermont Edition, it's our annual summer baseball program. And with us, as always, is VPR's sports director and all-around sports guru, Mitch Wortley. Mitch, great to have you back on the program. Great to be doing the baseball show.
Oh, I love it, Bob. I'm delighted to be with you. I got some chills listening to that Ohtani clip that you just played there. Remarkable stuff.
It really is. Mitch, let's look at some of the storylines of the first half of the season. Maybe most importantly, fans are back in the seats. This has to make a huge difference to everybody.
Yeah, I think it does. I think it feels and looks more like the baseball that we know and love. And Bob, you and I have talked about this. Last year it was just really hard to get into baseball. I know that you were away from the game for a while because of the pandemic. You know, I was flat out angry, to be honest about it, that Major League Baseball decided to play a season, even though it was only 60 games last year. I just thought it was irresponsible. But now seeing people come back, you know, hopefully with lots of immunizations and people taking the right precautions, it feels more like the game that we know and love because there's just nothing like going to the ballpark. You cannot replicate that experience.
You know, there was a time, I guess, last season, Mitch, and maybe this was true of baseball more than other sports, I'm not sure, but you notice that there wasn't anybody in the stands. There'd be a foul ball, places empty. You know, another foul ball, places empty. Home run, you could hear silence. It really seemed to affect baseball perhaps more than other sports.
I think it did. And, you know, I think it was made worse, too, because they were trying to pump in some of that artificial sound, you know, and I know they did that in other sports as well. But it's sort of like that at a baseball game, you know, it's different than a hockey game or football or basketball, frankly, to name the other major sports, because you have this sort of constant murmur throughout the game of the fans. Mm-hmm. You know, when the action isn't really happening, and there was a lot of that in baseball, to be frank about it, you can still hear just those sounds kind of wafting through the ballpark, and it's comforting. It's a little bit like, you know, a blanket noise or the white noise that people put on sometimes to help them sleep at night. That was missing from baseball. You could certainly tell the artificial sounds being pumped in. They weren't fooling anybody with that. It just felt different, and it wasn't right. And now I think it's getting back to the way it's supposed to be.
Do you think having fans in the stands and having that background noise, as you've just described it, makes a big difference not only to people watching at home or listening at home, but also for the players at the stadium?
It's got to. I mean, depending on the player, of course. You know, I think some players who may not love the shining moment when they're really in the spotlight – maybe they don't care that there's, you know, 30,000 screaming fans on a 3-2 pitch with the bases loaded and two outs. But I think the players, the really great superstars who live for those moments of being like, I'm the guy now. I'm, you know, it's up to me. Bring in this run. They love that excitement. They love that thrill. And I've heard them say it, you know, it pumps them up. It gets into their blood. It gets them maybe more concentrated. I think it's such an important part of the game. I think it's part of the reason why, again, I do not feel like the 2020 season was legitimate. All apologies to Los Angeles Dodgers fans out there. They won the World Series last year, but I don't think it's legitimate because those things were missing, because you didn't have the home field advantage. You didn't have that X factor of the fan. I think it's an important part of baseball, of all sports, and I just feel like it's more back to the way we're used to it, and I think the players like it better too.
I think you're exactly right. Today on the program, it's our annual summer baseball show. Your thoughts about the baseball season? 1-800-639-2211. As you just heard, Mitch did not like the 2020 season very much and was angry that the teams played and wonders what happens to all those statistics that happened during the season. What are your thoughts about that? Maybe you have some thoughts about this idea of starting a runner on second base if you go into extra innings. Now that we've seen it in use, is it as bad as you thought it was going to be? Is it better? Is it a good idea? We'd love to hear from you today. 1-800-639-2211. Second storyline, Mitch, Boston Red Sox. As you mentioned, when the season got underway, I was kind of lukewarm about baseball. I did not have a good feeling, as you did, for the 2020 season. I saw an early game. I said, well, where's that outfield of Mookie Betts, Jackie Bradley Jr., and Andrew Benintendi? They're gone. Who are all these pitchers? Never heard of these people.
Right.
But this has been a surprising first half of the season for the Boston Red Sox. Tell us about it.
Really incredible. And, you know, if you watch the beginning part of the season, let's not forget the Red Sox lost the first three games of their season. And they got swept badly by the team that is in last place now, the Baltimore Orioles, who are really, let's just face it, not very good. We know some Orioles fans here, so I'm not trying to pile on. But, you know, it looked for all the world like this was going to be a disaster of a season for the Red Sox. They lose those first three games. But this team, from that point on, is showing signs. You can't help but make the comparison of the team from 2013 that won the World Series that was also not expected to go anywhere that year. That was supposed to be a rebuilding year. I remember you and I doing the baseball show that year, and me, and not just me, but a lot of people saying, look, this team, they're rebuilding. This is a bridge year. They're going to do better next year. But that team surprised everybody. And this team in 2021 is showing a lot of echoes there. Yes, they lost that incredible outfield, the best defensive outfield I've ever seen as a Red Sox fan, with the killer bees, as they call them, Benintendi and Betts and Bradley Jr. But, you know, Alex Verdugo was the player that they traded Mookie Betts to for the LA Dodgers, and they got him back. Not as good as Mookie, no, but a very good player, a 5-2 player who can hit, run, throw, play good defense. Hunter Renfro has been put in as a platoon player in the outfield now. He is, if not a Gold Glove caliber player, he's close. He doesn't have a Gold Glove yet, but, you know, look up on YouTube. You can find the throw that he made to nail Matt Chapman of the Oakland A's at third base, one of the most remarkable throws from deep center field, Bob. I'm talking about way out by the garage door there. And he nailed him at third base on a throw, and he had room to spare. They have a pretty good outfield out there. They have really come around to put in these players who are their gutsy players, their platoon players in some cases. But give Chaim Bloom credit, the new GM for the Red Sox, putting together a team that feels like, with the core of Xander Bogaerts, Rafael Devers, J.D. Martinez, who are still with the team, that they can really do some special things this year. And they are defying expectations. First place in the American League East by about a game and a half over Tampa Bay, and looking really good. And don't forget, their best pitcher on the team hasn't even thrown a game yet. They're going to get Chris Sale back at some point this season, we believe. And that's like getting an amazing pitcher in a trade for giving up nothing.
Today in the program, it's our annual summer baseball show. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to John, who's calling from Shelburne. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Tell me why the infield fly rule is progressively getting pushed farther and farther out into the outfield this year. It seems to be worse this year than any other year.
That's a good point. I think I know the play you're talking about, John. I remember it might have been a Yankees game. The infield fly rule, for those who may not know it about it, you know, if the ball is popped up on the infield and there's a runner on, rather than let the ball drop automatically as an infielder might do and get a double play out of it, the umpire will call an automatic out for that, so that little strategy isn't deployed. Why it seems to be pushing further back into the outfield now? Because when it gets further back beyond the shortstop area into the outfield, it's no longer an infield fly rule. It's in no man's land, and it's up to the defense to catch the ball. I'm really not sure. Bob, do you know what he's talking about in that play there? Because I have seen this happen a couple times this year.
I have not seen the play, but if I remember this rule correctly, there's the word reasonable in it.
Yes.
That the infielder could make the play with a reasonable amount of effort. And I've always thought, boy, that opens up a can of worms.
It's subjective for sure. John, what have you noticed about the infield fly rule that seems to indicate to you that it's getting pushed further back?
Well, the play you talked about was a Yankees game.
Okay.
But there was also one in a Tampa Bay game, which I watched. It typically tends to be the shortstop. I don't know why, but they were a good 30 feet out into the outfield. And they called, before the ball was even close to being caught, they called it. And they called the runner at second out, and that was it. But there was still a chance that shortstop would not have caught the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't understand why it keeps – I mean, it's no longer an infield fly. So I guess I was just wondering if you knew anything more about that.
I wish I had some insight for you. I guess what I would say about it, though, is that I think you're right to have picked up on it, because – to me, the infield fly rule should be very much confined to the infield. And I know what Bob is saying about, you know, a reasonable expectation of catching the ball. But once you get beyond that shortstop area where you're between left field and shortstop in that no man's land, that should not be called an infield fly automatic out. You know, it's one of those blue pits that sometimes fall in, and that's part of baseball, you know. And I really believe that they should be a little more restrictive about where they call the infield fly rule.
Absolutely. John, thanks very much for your phone call. Mitch, I wanted to touch on a third storyline, and we certainly can go back and discuss the other ones as well. But it is, as we mentioned in the intro, quite a year for Shohei Ohtani of the Los Angeles Angels. Now, for folks who may not be following baseball all that closely, what's the big deal?
Oh, this guy is incredible. First of all, that home run clip you played when he hit home run number 33 this season, he broke the single-season record for home runs with that homer for a Japanese-born player. The previous record was set by Hideki Matsui of the New York Yankees back in 2004, who had, I believe, 31, maybe 32, I think it was 31 home runs the entire season. The entire season. And he held that record up until this year. Ohtani has passed that record for a Japanese-born player, and we're not even halfway, we're a little more than halfway through the season now. Remarkable. And he's doing something that we haven't seen since the days of Babe Ruth. He's an excellent pitcher and an excellent hitter. You just don't see that anymore. And they didn't have an all-star game when Ruth was playing in his years when he was doing both. So, you know, he couldn't be that first to do it. But what Ohtani is doing here to excel, not just be a decent hitter and a good pitcher, but to excel in both those areas is something that we just have not seen in the modern era, and he is a joy to watch. It's just wonderful.
You know, Mitch, it's interesting to do the Babe Ruth comparisons, and, you know, one thing I think we both love about baseball is statistics, and we're going to be discussing that in just a moment after the break. But Babe Ruth never had a season where he made 20 starts and had 200 plate appearances. In comparison, Ohtani this year already has 350 at-bats, and he's made 13 starts, and we're only halfway through the season. So it's an interesting comparison because that's what everybody thinks of, but it almost seems like Ohtani is in a league of his own, even when being compared to Babe Ruth.
Well, I think that's why in Japan they refer to Babe Ruth as the Japanese or the American Ohtani, You know what I mean? It's not the other way around. They understand his value there. Just a remarkable player.
Now, do you think that he can keep this up? We're talking about a 162-game season. Yeah. We're talking about pitching maybe every fifth or sixth day. We're talking about being a designated hitter on most days. This has got to take a physical toll on him, doesn't it?
I think that's something the Angels are very aware of, and if they're not, they should be. Because, yes, he's a remarkable athlete. He's certainly in better shape than Babe Ruth ever was when he played in his day. But you do want to, because baseball is a grinding kind of game where even the slightest injury can really put you out of the lineup for a long time. And when you're doing both pitching and hitting, you have just more opportunities to hurt yourself in different ways. It's amazing to me that he's lasted this long and played so well, even to this point in the season. But I do think the Angels are going to be very careful with him moving forward, because they know that along with Mike Trout, he is absolutely their most valuable player on that team, and somebody they hope to have for years and years to come.
I'm wondering, Mitch, if there's an analogy to any other sport. I was trying to think, well, let's see, if in football, maybe you're the quarterback, and maybe on defense, you're a linebacker. Then I was thinking, well, maybe it's a two-sport athlete like Danny Ainge, who played baseball for the Blue Jays and basketball for the Celtics. Can you think of another sports analogy that compares to this?
I mean, I think the two-sport analogy is the best one. I think of players that have done both. Deion Sanders excelled in baseball and in football. You had players like Bo. Why am I forgetting his last name now? Bo Jackson, the remarkable athlete who played for the Kansas City Royals and, of course, was an excellent football player. But, you know, injuries, to your point before, it took the toll. I mean, Bo Jackson ruptured his hip and could didn't last very long because of the toll that it all takes. But, yeah, to see a player like Ohtani come along and to do this, even though it's within the same sport, these are two very different skill sets, pitching and hitting. And to be that good at both is, I think, something. And a lot of people on the East Coast don't get to see him play because those games start so late at night. If you do get a chance, try to watch an Angels game. It is worth your while to see somebody, do something this amazing. And on days when he's pitching and then comes up to the plate and is hitting left-handed pitching like that clip showed, which is a very difficult thing to do as a left-handed hitter. He's the best left-handed swing that I've seen, certainly since Barry Bonds. He is worth watching, and he should bring you into baseball if you're not yet a baseball fan. He's a great way to get you into the game.
Well, joining us now is another big baseball fan. That's Clayton Trutor. He's a professor at Norwich University, also the Vermont State Chair of the Society for American Baseball Research. We're going to learn about that organization in just a moment. Clayton, great to have you on the program.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Mitch. It's a pleasure to come on and talk baseball on this lovely afternoon.
So, Clayton, I know some folks are wondering, what is the Society for American Baseball Research?
It's a organization which is currently having its 50th anniversary. We are the nation's leading baseball research organization, whether one's interested in advanced baseball statistics, which members of Sabre helped pioneer, or they're interested in the history of the game or the business of baseball. It's essentially a gathering place, both virtually, also in local chapters, for people interested in researching different aspects of the game, learning about new areas of research in baseball, and developing a degree of comradeship with other people who share these interests.
You know, I wonder, Clayton, if this goes back, if we look at Bill James, who worked for a while for the Red Sox, as sort of the father of sabermetrics, I can remember, this has got to be going back now 35 years, of a paperback publication that was known as the Baseball Abstract, I think, that Bill James had. And he always had some interesting article in there about, well, you thought this about baseball, but if you look at these statistics, you might come to a very different conclusion. Is that sort of the beginning of this new statistic world of baseball?
In many respects, it's the beginning of the popularization of it. Bill James, in fact, coined the term sabermetrics to describe this range of new analytics related to baseball, almost trying to create a science to make the game played more efficiently, offensively, defensively, in terms of pitching. So Sabermetrics in many ways is a catch-all term for a new brand of statistics which began emerging in the 1970s. Phil James, who was one of the early Saber people, is foremost among those people involved with shaping this. But it really describes a broad range of new advanced statistics which have come to shape the way the game is played and the way that the game is enjoyed by many of its fans.
You know, Clayton, there's a great scene in the movie Moneyball, which is based on Michael Lewis's book about the Oakland Athletics and general manager Billy Beane in the 2002 season, when the team's management and its scouts are evaluating ball players for the coming season. And on one side of the room, you have the old crusty scouts. The old guys have been doing this for 30 or 40 years. They get a feeling in their gut about a player. And on the other side of the room, you have all the data analysts who are saying, well, this is why this player is good, and that's why that player isn't good. What do you think in terms of the evaluation of talent? Do you think the scientific formula works better, or is it that gut feeling that the older scouts had that, you know, I think this player is going to be pretty good?
Initially, what's being depicted with the Oakland Athletics in that film, certainly the data guys ended up having a competitive advantage. They were looking at the game in a way that hadn't been looked at before. At this point, it's tough to tell because every single team employs a number of data analysts. In many ways, I think there's almost been a one-size-fits-all approach to baseball, which I think there's a degree of diminishing returns as a result of this, since everybody is looking for the same things, trying to make the game played in a more efficient manner, trying to score more efficiently, trying to prevent other teams from scoring in a more efficient manner. So I don't know how much it still works. Essentially, everybody is singing that same tune now.
Well, Clayton, let me ask you this. I'm sorry, Bob, to break in there, I wanted to ask him, do you like the statistical approach to baseball? Is this something you think is good for the game?
I think it depends on the lens you're using. If you're an individual team trying to figure out how to win, it's very understandable why you take this approach. As a fan, it leaves me a little bit cold. Essentially, the efficiencies in baseball have led to a game where there's a lot of home runs, a lot of guys striking out, and a lot of people walking. I think the offensive character of the game has taken on almost a slot machine quality. I very much, just as a spectator, prefer what was called small ball historically, bunting, stealing bases, hit and run, legging out doubles. In many ways, the more historically athletic features of the game have been kind of rubbed away as opposed to this move towards trying to create more efficient offensive production.
Yeah, I think
I understand why the teams do it, but just as a spectator, I find it less enjoyable than the way the game appeared, say, 25, 30 years ago.
Yeah, you know, it seems to me like the statistical approach can work for teams like the Oakland A's, because in that movie Moneyball Bob was referring to, they were dealing with the fact that they had so much less money to spend than the big spending teams, and so they had to take a different approach. Teams like the Tampa Bay Rays seem to have really thrived with the statistical approach, using some relievers to start games, etc. But I agree with you, Clayton. I really feel like those small ball aspects of the game, the art of moving a runner over, the art of the sacrifice, all seems to have gone by the wayside. And now everyone's swinging for the fences. And boy, you know, you can tell it's hurting the game because the balls aren't being put in play. So there's not much action on the field.
I think also for casual fans, it's a little disconcerting that all of a sudden, if you turn a game on, there's all this statistical analysis being placed on the screen. And unless you're very intensely involved with it, you have no idea what a lot of this stuff is.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in terms of baseball being interested in having the game continue to be a mass appeal spectacle, it's important to present this information in a way that's more digestible to a fan who isn't living and breathing analytical analysis.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to H, who is calling from Townsend. H, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I wanted to get your thoughts on the commission. I read somewhere that the commissioner's proposing to remove the shift.
Yes.
And this speaks to what you guys were just talking about, the statistical, how statistics have become so important. So I'm at a Fenway game a couple weeks ago, and there's a shift to left field, and there's only one guy fielding between first and second. And the hitter gets an outside pitch and puts it into this gaping hole in second. And I'm saying, yes. Why has it taken so long? And is this an anomaly? I talked to this, if you could. And go Mets.
Go Mets. Oh, we got a Mets caller. I love it. Bob, if I could take this real quick, I just want to, because H is talking to something that I am so concerned about. Maybe Clayton is concerned about this, too. Yes, Rob Manfred, the commissioner of baseball, is talking now about making some changes to these rule changes that were put in this year, including starting runners on second base in extra innings, which is absolutely hideous. He's talking about maybe getting rid of the doubleheaders being seven innings as they are this year. I kind of understand why they did that. But he's also talking about making the shift illegal. Now, I agree with H that the best thing to do when faced with the shift and there's like nobody covering third base is to bunt down the third baseline or hit the ball that way. Go the other way with it. You get an automatic hit. You don't even have to hit it hard. But I'm against removing the shift. I'm against making the shift illegal because this is not something that's new and it's not part of this new statistical analysis. This goes way back to the Ted Williams days. Ted Williams, the greatest left-handed hitter, the greatest hitter of all time in baseball, was a pull hitter. And he used, as a lefty, he would pull the ball to right field all the time. So players and teams to stop him would do the shift and they would move their infielders over to that right field side covering there and they'd try to stop him. And Ted Williams' answer to that, he was never going to hit the ball the other way and get a bunt. He had too much pride for that, was, well, I'm just going to hit the ball over their heads and into the stands. And they're not going to stop that unless they can fly. So I am against removing the shift. I am for players doing what they should be doing, which is to get the ball, hit the ball the other way. If they're going to abandon a part of the infield, hit the ball there, make them pay for it. It's that simple.
Clayton, what do you think about this? I mean, here's a great example. If you can look at statistics for a player over several seasons, you can see with every pitch, this is where this batter tends to bat the ball. It almost always is a pull hitter. Almost for a right-handed batter, it's always going on the left side of the infield. Armed with that information, we have now seen some really dramatic shifts going on. What are your thoughts about the shift?
I agree. I think the tinkering with the rules generally just makes people more unhappy. It creates its own new set of problems. I think the game will tend to correct itself. I think baseball's had a problem for almost a half century now, just very frequently tinkering with the rules, whether it was lowering the mound, adding the designated hitter, these various rule changes in the last couple of years. I mean, I guess they're COVID related, but I think in essence, they are experimentations with trying to adapt the game to the contemporary world. I think these tinkerings generally, they take a game that's good, they try to perfect it, they end up creating their own set of problems. I think in a broader sense, baseball's had an identity crisis since the late 1960s, since football displaced it as the nation's most popular spectator sport. And I think baseball keeps thinking that if we make this little change, if we make that little change, we'll return to our historic cultural spot. But I don't think it's that simple. Baseball is a game that still is the heartbeat for tens of millions of people around the country all summer. I don't think it really has a ton of problems. I think many of the issues that they have now are the product of efforts to correct previous problems.
Clayton, we were talking about any number of statistics that have come out of the sabermetric movement in the last 30 or 35 years. I can remember that way back when Bill James started talking about on-base percentage and why that was important. Right now, that seems like a pretty simple statistic. I'm just wondering, as you look at different statistics that have come out, you mentioned watching a game and you're inundated with stats and pitching arm levels and spin speed. But are there some statistics that you think have actually been good for the game to take a look at?
For pitchers, I look at WHIP all the time, walks and hits per innings pitched. I think it gives you a good sense of how efficiently they're working on the mound, to what degree they're allowing these different variables in terms of base runners to come into the game. That strikes me as a very good way of determining the quality of a pitcher. WAR, wins over replacement, is a commonly seen statistic now. It's a product of a range of factors. It's essentially a way of figuring out how good your player is relative to what would be the baseline average player at a time. I think especially when it comes to figuring out things like the Hall of Fame, looking at wins over replacement, which gives you in many ways a comprehensive look at a player's contributions, is a helpful statistic in terms of comparing people between eras. So I think there are some definite benefits to it. And I think almost all of these analytical things, if you're running a ball club, make complete sense to focus on. The degree to which the average fan needs to be worrying about them or should be presented with them on a regular basis, I think that's a question, more of a question for me.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Chris, who is calling from Buell Verdeer, Texas. Chris, welcome. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Hello, gentlemen and Dr. Treder. I had a question that he may have already answered, but I was just reading George Will's article this week in the Washington Post, and he mentioned the different things that could possibly be done to change the game. And as a baseball traditionalist, my knee-jerk reaction is no, don't do anything. But he brought up a very good point, for example, on the moving back of the mound. He brought up that Whitey Ford back in the 50s was 5'10", and now you have players that average 6'3", 6'4", so they have effectively moved the mound closer because they throw harder and they in essence throw closer to the hitters. And Will was making, I don't know if I agree with it, but it was a compelling argument to moving the mound back, among other things. And I just wanted to know what Dr. Treder thought about that.
I understand the concept. I'm a little hesitant to tinker with the rules. I think the game will find a way to correct itself and evolve based on these situations. My one fear, though, is certainly, though, if a player, as a result of the mound being where it is, as players get bigger and stronger and can throw harder, if a player gets very seriously injured or killed by a pitch, I think that would almost certainly prompt some kind of a change. I think certainly with football, we've seen this in recent years with many of the injuries that have come out prominently as a result of concussions, among other things. The very obvious publicly presented incidents of players getting hurt tend to lead to changes in sports. And I think in baseball that could be the case as well.
Professor Treder, real quick, didn't Major League Baseball also lower the mound at one point in the late 60s, pretty much because of Bob Gibson and his dominance on the mound?
Well, I would say it's not just Bob Gibson, but more broadly in the late 1960s. It was the era of the pitcher. 1968 in particular was called the year of the pitcher. You had Carl Yastrzemski leading the American League in batting with a .301 batting average. Mm. And baseball reacted quite dramatically by lowering the mound to take away some of the, I guess torque of the pitcher in terms of getting the ball towards the mound. And it did in the short term play some role in improving offense. But even that, I think in many ways was the starting point of the tinkering with which I'm uncomfortable. And I think it's no coincidence that corresponds with the early days of the Super Bowl, when pro football was beginning to take on this outsized role in the culture, that baseball was trying to find a way to respond to it. And they figured a decline in offense was one of the major reasons that people were losing interest. If you look at the rule changes baseball has made in the past 50 years, or some of the policies they've had in this time period, they tended to be either aimed at increasing offense or speeding up the game. The problem is oftentimes these two aspects are cross purposes. The things that lead to an increase in offense often make the game last longer. So it's I think, a self-defeating proposition, a lot of these efforts at tinkering with the game to try to perfect it.
Clayton Treder, many thanks for joining the program today and your insight about statistics in baseball. We really appreciate you being on the program.
Oh, thank you both so much for your time. It's been a pleasure, and I'd encourage people to go check out sabr.org, which is our national website. Our local chapter in Vermont is at SaberVT on Twitter. We meet regularly on Zoom. We talk with baseball authors. We share research, and we'll be getting back to having actual physical meetings in the very near future. And I hope to hear from some of your listeners for our local chapter. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's great information. I have a very quick question for you, Mitch. As we know, doubleheaders are going on this year. Doubleheaders are being limited to 7 innings each. When a pitcher throws a no-hitter for 7 innings and wins the game, does it count as a no-hitter?
Shouldn't. Nope. Sorry. It's not nine innings. It's wonderful. It's incredible. I couldn't pitch seven innings, period, but a no-hit ball, no. No. And, you know, if they get rid of the seven-inning doubleheader thing next year, I think that's great. I think they're doing it this year. I can understand why. Again, we're coming off a COVID year in which they shouldn't have played at all. And they're trying, you know, to limit these games, the exposure of the players, et cetera. But no, a no-hitter is nine innings of no-hit ball, not seven.
I just wanted to clarify that with you. Let's go back to our call. Let's go back to our listeners and talk to Ziggy, who's calling from Newport. Hey, Ziggy, welcome to the program.
Love talking baseball. Nice program, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Just a quick comment before I make my point from your caller from Townsend and at the Red Sox game like that at Fenway. And, boy, what a nice feel. I haven't been there since 82 was the last time. But I'm a Yankee fan, and he was a Mets fan. But anyways, when you see a little ground ball dribbler go through the other side of the infield when there's against the shift, and the ball just dribbles into the outfield. It's such a nice feeling, and such few ball players do that. And it's whether it's the right side of the infield or the left side of the infield, regardless of where the shift is. It's amazing that so few players take advantage of that.
I can't believe I'm agreeing with a Yankees fan, but go ahead, Ziggy. You're absolutely right.
And talking about Ohtani. Again, I happened to catch a few California Angel games against the Yankees this past weekend, and he's such an exciting ball player. And a kid, for one, he's a handsome kid. He's a good-looking kid. He's got Hollywood good looks, and he's always looks like he's having fun. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's the first time I saw him play in live games. And I said, oh, my God, how can people not root for a kid like this?
I got to agree with you. You know, he's the most exciting, certainly Japanese player I've seen since Ichiro, who's one of my personal favorites of all time. But you're right. He has this look on his face like he's just a kid who's out there playing Little League. He's loving what he's doing, and he's just so darn good at it. I agree with you, Ziggy. He's a joy to watch.
Ziggy, thanks very much for your phone call. It is our annual summer baseball show here at Vermont Edition. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. Well, joining us right now is C.J. Knutson, who is Senior Vice President of the Vermont Lake Monsters. C.J., welcome back to Vermont Edition. Great to have you.
Well, thanks very much for having me. I can't believe we're halfway through the Major League Baseball season already.
I know, time is just flying by this summer. Well, your organization had to make a big shift. Previously, you were a minor league affiliate of the Oakland Athletics, but then Major League Baseball, for a reason that still escapes me, decided to eliminate dozens of minor league teams. The Lake Monsters were one of them. Now you play in the Futures Collegiate Baseball League. So tell us how the Lake Monsters made this transition. How's it gone?
Well, the most important thing is having baseball in Vermont and in the Burlington community. And really one way for us to maintain baseball here was by joining the Futures League, which is a collegiate wooden bat league that's been around for about 11 years or so. And so far, it's been really successful for us this summer.
What's the fan response been like, CJ? Yeah. I'm sorry, Bob.
Well, you know, it's a great question, Mitch. You know, I wasn't sure, you know, because this is my first time really seeing this type of ball in this league. And I've had numerous season ticket holders that have been here at Centennial for 27 years, watching the Expos and the Lake Monsters. And just about every night, a new one will come up to me and say they really enjoy this quality of baseball. They think it's much better than the New York Penn League. And it really is exciting for fans to watch. You know, there's lots of home runs. There's lots of great plays in the field. And these guys are really, it's a high level of baseball. And I think the fans are very pleased with our move to the Futures League.
And CJ, what are some of the biggest transitions you had to make to go from a minor league affiliate to a collegiate all-star team? What are some of the challenges you had? And maybe there's some pros and cons here.
Yeah, it's you know, when we were an affiliate of the A's and part of that the Nationals, those affiliates would actually provide us our players and coaching staff, and in return we provide a place to play, which is Centennial Field. With the Futures League, everything is 100% on us. So we're responsible for finding the players to play on the team. We're responsible for finding the coaches to actually coach and manage the team here. And so it's we have 100% control over who plays for us, which is tremendous. One of the biggest challenges we had, not only trying to field a team, we had everything. We had to put together a franchise in about 2 months. The new owner, Chris Inglis, purchased the franchise on March 15th from Ray Pecor, and we were off to the races. And we opened up on May 29th with our home opener. So we were really behind the eight ball, but we opened up very successfully, and it's been a lot of fun this summer.
CJ, one of the things I remember, I think we talked to you a while back before the season started, and one of the things that you mentioned was going to happen was something about, and please correct me if I'm wrong here, but with tie games late, you go to a home run derby format to decide the game. Is that right? And don't worry, because I'm not against that at this level in the Futures League at all. If it was in the majors, believe me, I'd be ranting about it. But tell me, remind us again about what that is, if that is happening, and if it's been fun, if you had to do it much.
Yeah, actually, if we're tied after the 10th inning, we go into a home run derby. And so the teams compete against each other in a home run derby, and whoever hits the most home runs wins the ball game. So it's definitely a non-traditional format. But unfortunately, we haven't had to do it here in Vermont. I think we've done it once on the road, but we have yet to have that issue here or that challenge here in Burlington. But I know our fans are looking for that because it'd be a ton of fun. And,
it's got to happen eventually, at Centennial Field. And I think that would be a blast. I really do.
It would be tremendous. You know, I just got back literally an hour ago from Connecticut from the All-Star game in New Britain, Connecticut. The game was last night. The night before was a home run derby. And wasn't sure how many home runs these guys were going to be able to hit out of the stadium. But the first round, one guy hit 9 home runs. The second guy hit 7 home runs. And these guys were just literally crushing the ball. And these guys are a tremendous athlete. And, they're excited to be here. But, unfortunately, our season's winding down. We have less than 30 days before our regular season wraps up here.
Oh, wow.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Steve, who's calling from Thetford. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, guys. Thank you. Say, I agree with some of the points that Mitch made earlier, particularly the small ball and how that has gone away. And so these days, I think the numbers show that there either have been strikeouts or home runs. And the hitters know that they get paid for home runs, and so people have altered their swing style to increase the trajectory, and it has made it a lot more boring. And so I understand that the commissioner wants to increase the fan base, especially among younger fans, and they've put in a number of gimmicks. I don't like the runner on second base in extra innings. Mm. So I'm more of a traditionalist. I know they tried to speed up the game, but Jim Palmer of the Orioles pointed out one very easy way they could do that, and that is to try to keep the batters from stepping out and readjusting the batting gloves after every plate appearance or every pitch, and that really slows things down a lot. And then last, about the Red Sox, I have to admit I'm a long-suffering Orioles fan, but I'm not sure the Red Sox have the starting pitching this year, despite the return of Chris Sale, and I think it still remains to be seen whether it's the old Sale or whether all those innings on that arm have taken their toll.
Yeah,
Thanks very much. I've enjoyed the show.
Thank you, Steve. That's an excellent point about Chris Sale, because when he does come back, they've got to be awfully careful with him. You know, he's gone through Tommy John surgery, and he's got a history. He's a thin guy. He's like Pedro Martinez. And, he's a little bit frail in that sense, but he is one of the best pitchers in the game when he's on his game. And it's true about the starting pitching with the Red Sox. I don't know how they're in first place, given that they've had some good starts from guys like Nathan Eovaldi. Nick Pivetta had a great start to the year, but he's fallen off recently. But they've cobbled it together. The bullpen has been excellent. That's helped them win a lot of games. Matt Barnes is having a career year. So the Red Sox are still in it. The thing to watch for them in the second half to see if this is real or if they start to fade is something that 2013 team did, which I think is a remarkable statistic. That team in 2013 never lost more than 3 games in a row all season long. That's pretty incredible. I don't know yet about this 2021 team. Maybe someone who does know can tell me if they've lost 3 in a row or more at this point. They've definitely lost 3 in a row, but that's something to watch. When a team is that consistent, playing that well over a long period of time, doesn't matter if you have the superstars or not or the big names, you can go all the way if you have that kind of consistency.
CJ, I just wanted to ask you, we got about a minute left. It seems like there's almost a boom in collegiate baseball going on. I'm thinking about the Futures League that the Lake Monsters play in. I'm thinking about the New England Collegiate Baseball League that the Mountaineers and the Nighthawks play in. There's always the Cape Cod League. There's a very popular league up in Alaska. Are we seeing a renewed interest in baseball at this level?
Without a doubt. I think it's really, really fortunate for us to be part of the Futures League. And as we said, we can make our roster. And so we have about six or seven guys that are on our team here that are from Vermont, that played high school baseball in Vermont. And so when kids come to the ballpark here to cheer on the Lake Monsters, literally 4, 5, 6, 7 years later, they can be playing for the Lake Monsters. So I think it really is helping to grow the game and helping to grow the excitement in this area.
C.J. Knutson, Senior Vice President of the Vermont Lake Monsters, a team now playing in the Futures Collegiate Baseball League. C.J., many thanks for being on the program.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to seeing you guys at Centennial Field.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Mitch, last quick question for you. I know you didn't like the idea of home runs at the end of maybe the 10th inning to decide a game, but what about, you're a big hockey fan, what about penalty shots at the end of the game?
You mean penalty shots in baseball? I don't think that's going to work.
No. But I mean, is it okay for hockey, but you just don't want it for baseball?
Well, I love it for the Futures League. I want to be absolutely clear about that. I think it sounds remarkable and wonderful and fun to do that at the Futures League level. Penalty shots in hockey happen in the regular season. That's how they decide games instead of a tie. I think that's okay. But what's so great about hockey is in the playoffs, once you get to that level, you're never going to have that runner on second base, so to speak. It's always going to be whoever scores the goal in overtime. Look at the heartbreak that happens in soccer. We just saw in the Euros when you have to go down to penalties to decide a game. It just seems so awful for everyone who's worked so hard. End it in real time. That's just where I fall on that. There's nothing as exciting as playoff hockey, a sudden death overtime game, which can go 3-4 overtimes till somebody scores.
I'm with you 1,000%, and I think back to the tennis match probably about 10 years ago when the U.S. Open, when the score of one of the sets was 76-74. I don't know if you remember that, but I say play it till the end. Hey, Mitch, many thanks for being on the program today. We love the Summer Baseball Show and just a lot of enthusiasm about baseball. Many thanks, Mitch.
Thank you so much, Bob. It's always a pleasure.